Welcome to episode 362 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we have a grand conversation with resident punk, rock and roll historian, and co-author of Please Kill Me, The Uncensored Oral History of Punk, Legs McNeil. We also have an EWSA titled Conformity. Our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, shares an essay titled The Myth of Icarus. And we have a poem called Paste. All of this, of course, as is always the case, will be imbued and infused with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It's so nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 362 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. Conformity. Get off my grass, you punk. Who do you think you are peddling that junk? Questioning authority with nasty inquiries, suggesting that we don't take into account what is best for us and the rest. Just follow our lead, and you will certainly succeed in the eyes of the man and in the ways dictated through nature by Almighty God. Don't imply that I am a fraud, you stinking punk. Why don't you work and dress and finesse like the Wall Street hunks and like those classy ladies wearing the power skirts and button-down dress shirts and the classy men in their Brooks Brother boxer briefs fantasizing about silk sheets and lace panties while you go commando and your females trade in public toilets their cotton underpants. At a glance, you would think we are the same. But you don't get the game. You deep down know we time and time again will put you to shame. We are manning all of the towers of power, and you cannot accept it. You just complain. Our patriarchy is the way. You will die young in your personal rebellion as you delude yourself to believe that you are a bad mofo of a hellion. Punks have no place in our race toward success. You are all a mess. But perhaps I digress. Follow us. Get on the bus. Have faith and trust. Everything will be okay once you embrace our well-mannered conformity. Otherwise, please kill me.
When I say I'm in love, you best believe I'm in love, L-U-V. Looking for a kiss. Well, won't you tell me why those kids are moving so slow? Is it that they just don't have a place to go? When the day starts breaking, the sun is gonna shine. It's hard to sleep if I've been trying. And all the old ladies, they're all on their way to church. To go to church, I'm begging, will I be alone? Looking for a kiss. When everyone's going to your house to shoot up in your room, most of them are beautiful, but so obsessed with gloom. I ain't gonna be here when they all get home. They're always looking at me, they won't leave me alone. I didn't come here looking for no sex. I know I've been howling on streets all night long. Just looking for a kiss. I need a fix and a kiss. I need a fix and a kiss. I need a fix and a kiss. I'm looking for a kiss.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. McNeil. Is that you?
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have on Troubadours and Rock on Tours this go-around, Roderick Legs McNeil. Let's give a little background information before we get into a nice conversation. Legs McNeil is the co-author of The Other Hollywood, the uncensored oral history of the porn film industry. He was the former resident punk at Punk Magazine, a senior editor at Spin, and regularly contributes to Vice Online. And, of course, Mr. McNeil co-authored with Gillian McCain, Please Kill Me, The Uncensored Oral History of Punk, a classic work credited with reinvigorating the oral history genre. Mr. McNeil and Ms. McCain are presently working on another work of uncensored oral history that is a prequel to Please Kill Me. It focuses on the 1960s and is titled 69. Troubadours and Rock on Tours is happy to have on the show Roderick Legs McNeil. Thank you, sir, for taking time out.
Well, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm very excited. And before we get into our discussion about the art and craft of constructing an oral history. Let's get a little background information to set the tone for the listeners. You know, how about telling us about your boyhood days in Connecticut and how you ended up in the Bowery?
I was born in 1956. My dad died about 2 months after my mom worked. I had an older brother and an older sister, and I was born with one leg 2 inches longer than the other, and I have a very severe case of dyslexia, so I didn't do well in school, and I started drinking when I was 12 or 13, and didn't like Connecticut at all, and had met up in Connecticut with a guy named John Holmstrom, who wanted to be a cartoonist. He was an artist, and when I moved to New York in 1974, it was in with him behind the School of Visual Arts on 24th Street. So that's kind of how it started.
And then it being, I think, Punk Magazine, right? How did that start?
Well, we had made this really... I directed this really bad movie called The Unthinkables about gangsters who couldn't do anything right. And it was silent film, black and white. And that's when Jed Dunn and John and I really got together. And we wanted to do something, you know. John had brought... We were spending the summer in Connecticut, and John brought this album up that he learned from Lester Bangs at Cream Magazine, The Dictators Go Girl Crazy, which basically kind of told our story in music, and it was great. It was a great album, and we really, you know, they were in the inside sleeve jacket, they were in black leather jackets sitting around a White Castle, and we thought, oh, that's us. And we just loved it. And we were driving. John said he wanted to start a magazine about comics and rock and roll. And he said, I want to call it Teenage News. And I said, that's a stupid name. Why don't we call it Punk? And they all started laughing, and they thought that was a great idea. And John said, I'll be the editor. And Jed said, I'll be the publisher. And they looked at me, and they said, what are you going to do? And John said, oh, you can be the resident punk. Ha, ha. You know, he was hysterically laughing. So that's kind of how it started. But we had not seen the Ramones. We didn't even know CBG. I think John knew that CBGBs existed, but I certainly didn't. And I also didn't read rock and roll magazines, you know. I couldn't afford them.
like Cream, for example, that you mentioned.
Yeah, John read them. John read all the rock mags.
Well, you know, the term punk, how did you come up with that? I mean, some people say...
Well, it wasn't that hard. It was, you know, what everybody had called me all my life. You know what you are? You're a punk, you know? You know? And also, they used it on, you know, all the crime shows. You know, when they finally caught the bad guy in the end, they couldn't say, you motherfucker.
FCC legs. FCC legs.
Or whatever they said, you know. They said, you know... You're a punk. You're a dirty punk, you know?
I got it, yeah. Now, when you're talking about Punk Magazine, you know, we're discussing the art and craft of oral history. Would you say Punk Magazine was an oral history of the punk scene as it was developing?
Yeah, you could say kind of. Punk Magazine was kind of important because it showed us that we could actually do something and publish. You know, John was working his ass off and really was, you know, the brilliant genius behind Punk Magazine. I was just kind of following along and doing what I could, you know. But yeah, I would, Punk Magazine was a great education, I must say.
Well, you know, one of the big interviews, I guess the first interview was with Lou Reed, right, I think?
Yes, yeah. And that was the first night we went to CBGB's, we saw the Ramones, and Lou was sitting there, you know? And I said, hey, John, there's that guy you're always playing. Because he was always playing Metal Machine music, which I thought was awful. And we went up to Lou, and I said, yeah, we're going to interview you, you know? And John said, yeah, we'll even put you on the cover. At which point Lou looked at John and deadpanned, "Your circulation must be fabulous." You know, you know, he was very funny. You know, but you know, we went to the local. He was with Rachel, his transsexual girlfriend, and it was me, Mary Harron, who later directed a bunch of movies.
Yeah, I know.
American Psycho. Yeah,
exactly.
Psycho and stuff like that. And she thought we were being so amateurish. And after the interview, John was jumping up and down when we got out of the locale, which was right next to the Bottom Line. And John was jumping up and down and said, "We got Lou Reed for the cover. We got Lou Reed for the cover." And I said, "Yeah, but did you see that chick he was with?" And Mary Harron was just horrified by our behavior, you know.
Well, you guys were like 19, weren't you? You're kids.
Right? I was 19. John was 4 years older, so 19 and 4 is...
23.
He was 23, yeah. So...
Yeah, we had a pre-conversation, Legs and myself, and I'm a mathematician, so I felt confident just taking that role and that responsibility and of adding for you.
You could add 4 and 19?
Yeah, pretty impressive, right?
You're a genius.
Thank you.
You're
sir.
A genius.
It means
man.
A lot. It means a lot coming from
yeah.
you. So you're 19, early 20s. Lou's probably about 10 years older, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And did you interview him? Well, I guess it was an ensemble of you guys talking with him. Do you think that started planting a seed in your head about how the narrative, first person narrative, could really be powerful?
No. It wasn't until I saw it. What John did with the interview, he you know, did it in this. Lou was talking about all his favorite cartoonists, like Wally Wood and Harvey Kurtzman, or, you know, just different cartoonists who had a very distinctive style. And John drew, you know, Lou talking about these cartoonists in the style of what he was of the cartoonists he was talking about. So it was very. It was very inspiring, the whole. And once we saw the first issue of Punk come together, it was so cool, and it was so much fun, you know.
Yeah, and then, you know, that went on for quite some time, and you were firsthand involved in the punk scene. You know, you read the book, which I have, and it's an amazing book. It's so, you can't put it down. It's so powerful. It's funny. It's heartbreaking, and it's compelling. But you were right there in the thick of things, too, which must have helped, rather than just someone who knew about a certain time period and went in and tried to gather enough information and enough voice to create the narrative. You were there.
Yeah, well, what was nice about doing Please Kill Me was that I could actually call these people up and say, "Hey, can I talk to you?" And they say, "Yeah, sure," you know. So it was much easier because people knew me, you know. So I had access, you know. I had access to people who were in the room.
Well, and
you know.
Should we fast? I mean, we're talking the 1970s into the 80s, and then you start working on this book when?
About 91, 92, I somewhere along there. Dee Dee Ramone had come to me, and he had just left the Ramones, and he wanted. I think he left in 89, and he wanted me to do a book with him. And I was friends with Jillian, and Jillian kept saying, "It's bigger than Dee Dee. It's bigger than Dee Dee." You know,
Jillian again.
Jillian McCain. Yeah.
Yeah, Jillian McCain, your co-author.
Yes.
And she was she's a poet as well as...
She was working at St. Mark's Poetry Project.
Right.
And she does a great imitation because she did Monday, Wednesday, and I think Sunday nights, you know, the poetry readings. And she does a great imitation of me coming over, and I would always giggle, you know, there'd be these serious poets up there going, you know, I would just start laughing. Because, you know, most of the poets were not that great, you know. So, and she'd say, "I'd come in my leather jacket and it would be squeaking, you know, the leather would be squeaking." And I'd say, "Hey, let's go out for a cigarette." And then I'd never come back.
I guess once a resident punk, always.
Always a resident punk.
And Were you aware of Plimpton and Stein, George Plimpton and
Oh yeah, yeah. That was kind of the basis of Jillian and my relationship. We were always talking about how great we were, really, really influenced by Edie, and we kept saying, "Why doesn't anyone else do that? This is such a great form, you know? Because there's no writer offering his opinion. It's just, you know, going from one person who was there in the room when something important was happening, you know, and if you edit it correctly, it could be a masterpiece, you know.
Now you're referencing Edie, American Girl, Gene Stein and George Plimpton.
George Plimpton, yes,
yeah,
yes.
Their oral narrative, oral history.
Yeah.
And they pretty much invented the genre, right?
They did. Well, Gene Stein had done a book before that about Bobby Kennedy and about his assassination, and I think that was kind of the start of her her road to Edie. You know, I think it was done about maybe 10 years before, maybe 5 years before, and
so in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah. When did Edie come out? 80, 80, 81?
82. 1982.
Okay, yeah. And I think that's what really solidified the oral history, the narrative, what we call the narrative oral history, as a genre, you know?
And you're...
It was definitely Gene Stein and George Plimpton. So Jillian and I were, you know, really in love with that, and we kept, you know, talking. And we're still talking about it, you know?
Yeah, and your book came out in 96.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know what I looked at that essay that you asked me to read. A few times I read it, and there, you know, certain ideas that stuck in my head, like the idea of the editorial voice coming from how you craft the narrative.
Right.
It's of its own. It's not yours, it's not Jillian's.
Yes. And it's also, and it also has to be based on what actually happened, you know. You know, so it's really kind of challenging, quite challenging.
I remember you talking about how first you put the chapters together, and you have to have a sound structure. That was your responsibility, basically, and the legitimacy and the themes was more so Jillian's responsibility. And you, once you get the chapters together, then you have to try to figure out a way to string or connect, or I don't know if it's a transitional thing.
You're right. Exactly right. Yeah.
Explain that to us a little bit. How does that, I mean, what are the challenges there? What do you mean by, isn't it a chronological
thing? Basically, I construct, you know, we do a massive amount of interviews, and then as we're doing on 69 right now, we've kind of done most of the interviews. And then I construct it, and then I send it to Jillian, and then we start arguing. Which, you know, it's quite good, the arguments we have, you know. Because out of those arguments, you know, you can really get something, you know. I present my case, she presents her case, and then we kind of discuss them, and it's actually very, very addictive. But the important thing about an oral history is you only want people who were in the room. You know, I keep saying that in this interview. You want people who were in the room when something happened. You don't want anyone's opinion about anything unless it has directly to do with them being in the room when something happened, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like when in Please Kill Me, when Stiv Bators gets a
FCC legs
on stage, you just want to talk to all the people who were there and watched it. You
and
know?
That, he's with the Dead Boys, is that right?
Yes, the Dead Boys, lead singer of the Dead Boys. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. They came in from Cleveland, and
yeah,
that was at CBGB's.
Yes, that was at CBGB's.
You know what
and
I noticed? Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I forget the stories now. It's been a long time, but
well, it's in the book. We're talking to Legs McNeil. By the way, if you just tuned in, one of the great American oral history writers, editors, I don't know how to put it, not a writer, I guess, editors, sculptors, working on a new project with his longtime partner in crime, Jillian, and Jillian is McCain, her last name, by the way. We're looking at a new book coming out, maybe in time of for the 25th anniversary of Please Kill Me, right? I mean, that'll be
probably.
And it's a prequel, the 1960s you're focusing on. But before we get to that, I want to, you know, the common themes, this need to have good themes, common characters, a thread. I found throughout the book, Iggy Pop kept popping up, so to speak. Was that intentional? Did you find him as such a compelling figure?
Iggy's one of the stars, you know. And Iggy kind of, you know, with the Velvets beforehand, they kind of were the prequel to Iggy. You know, they kind of broke all the barriers and you know, I mean, the Velvets kind of defined what modern music would become, you know, in every genre, you know, goth, you know, country and western, you know, I mean, there's everything in the Velvets, you know, noise, you know, industrial rock, you know. So, and then John Cale and Nico both go to Ann Arbor. You know, John Cale produces the first Stooges record, and then Nico goes to Ann Arbor and has an affair with Iggy. So you can see the connection there. But Iggy kind of, I mean, Alice Cooper said to me, you know, we were kind of faking it and being showbiz, and Iggy was the real thing, you know?
Yeah.
Which I think Alice would cop to today, you know?
And Iggy's still around. It's amazing all the stuff that he's been through.
Yeah, I know. Iggy's great.
You talk about Ann Arbor. That's and Iggy coming up the hard way, just as the Dead Boys. I guess that's part of the punk scene, right? I mean, these folks are representative of a certain human experience in the world. Even when you go over to England and you're talking about the Sex Pistols or the Clash, even though some of that was manufactured, so those characters, they came up hard, all of them.
Well, the great thing about the punk scene was that a bunch of people, whether they were in Australia, England, or the United States, a bunch of people who had nothing created something, which is kind of amazing when you think about it.
It is.
And they created something vital and great, you know.
Do you think the time period in which it spawned is significant?
Yes, because America was just, you know, desolate. You know, it was just, especially New York City, it was the end of white flight. Everybody, you know, with money had moved out of New York City and abandoned it, you know, and most of the other cities, with the exception of Los Angeles, you know, and England too, you know. I mean, it was, you know, we were in the middle of a, you know, Ford told New York City to drop dead. You know, it was really kind of a, you know, there was a gas shortage. It was kind of a bad time.
Yeah, and we're talking again the 70s into the 80s. You had disco popping up too.
Yeah.
And I know the 60s movement for a lot of punk people, including yourself, I gather, was getting out of control with the self-indulgence and you know, the hippie hugging and all that.
Yeah. Well, you know, like most mass movements, they really can't be hip because they just get homogenized as they get bigger and bigger, you know.
You know what I learned from your book as well is the sort of trajectory or the chronology of glitter to glam to punk, right?
Yeah, it was kind of interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah, very interesting.
I didn't know all that stuff. The John Vaccaro and Charles Ludlum, you know, Theater of the Ridiculous and Glitter and where it, you know, actually came from, you know.
Yeah, there's a theatrical sort of ancestry to it all.
Well, in the early 70s and the late 60s, it was much hipper to be in underground theater than it was to be in rock and roll, which I thought was kind of fascinating, you know.
Yeah, you know, I had a guy on one time, I don't know if you ever heard of him, Peter Schumann, Bread and Puppet Theater in the Village.
Yes.
And they were radicals. They were out there, you know, tear the government down was their adage, basically.
Yeah.
But no, what was cool about them is once they started getting too popular, they moved to Vermont. They said, this is not, you know, this is not cool anymore.
Yeah.
Going along with your mass movement insight. Yeah.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest.
Now, I wanted to ask you, after punk, would you say then came grunge?
And the grunge came, well, the 80s came along. The 80s was a horrible time. That's when I was working at Spin, and we were putting Madonna on the cover and Stink and Bon Jovi, you know. It was a horrible time for music, you know.
I love Spin magazine, though. My compliments, sir. I preferred it to Rolling Stone. I used to read it all the time.
Spin was an anomaly.
Yeah.
Spin, it was okay, but it wasn't great, you know?
Now, so you didn't have, it wasn't your most special fun job ever?
No. No, God, no.
It wasn't
punk.
Spin
was horrible. Spin was the worst.
So let me ask another question about, I guess, some of your experiences that fed into the oral history of Please Kill Me. You know, some of the people that you hung out with, Lou Reed, as you mentioned. How about the New York Dolls or Patti Smith, the Ramones? Of course, we didn't even talk about the Ramones. Talking about punk and not talking about the Ramones is odd. What kind of people were these folks?
Really interesting, really smart. You know, not classically smart, but you know, university smart, but they were doing something that they had to do. You know, it was they were great people and they were funny. They were fun. It was a fun time. You know that 75 to 80 was a great time. You know.
What about some of the folks like, you know, the side characters in a way? You talk about the importance of putting together an oral history to have included those folks that aren't up front, you know, but they're part of the scene. People like, because they give you a lot of times the greatest insight. They're more open. People like Sable Starr or Lee Black Childers, Hilly Crystal, Danny Fields. Tell me about those folks.
When Danny Fields and Lisa Robinson walked into CBGB's, you know, you stood up a little straighter, you know, you sobered up a little bit because, you know, I worked for Lisa Robinson doing the writing stories for Hit Parader. So, you know, you didn't want to get fired. You didn't want to insult them, you know, and once they left, you could go back to being, you know, a drunken fool, you know, it was fun. But Danny was always there, you know, chewing gum. You know, looking at you, going, "I see you. Yeah, I see what you're doing." Danny was great, though. You know, Danny's still great.
Yeah, I saw a documentary recently on Netflix, and he seemed pretty cool. He seems pretty. I don't know. I guess wise and kind, and he has a good sense of humor.
And very good taste.
Yeah, of course.
And very, very, very excellent. You know, Danny. You know, he. Yeah, that's why the book was dedicated to Danny Fields, because I was thinking, we were talking at the end of the book, Jillian and I, and I said, you know, if it wasn't for Danny, maybe a lot of this music would not have made it, you know, onto record, you know, because Danny really fought for Iggy and Nico and, you know, all these great bands, and later the Ramones, you know. I mean, you kind of need someone who can talk to record companies, and Danny was that guy, you know?
Yeah, there's a particular name for the position that he held that they called, like, a company freak, I think it was?
Yeah, company freak, yeah. Because they said the record companies didn't know what was going on in the street, and Danny did, you know?
And they probably weren't willing to go out and check it out, and he loved it, it seems.
Although Seymour was at CBGB's a lot, you know, with Linda Seymour Stein and Linda Stein, who was the head of Sire Records.
Yeah.
So, but by the, that was kind of in the early, in the 60s, Danny was company freak. But by the 70s, you know, he had a lot of respect and not a lot, but he was recognized as being a guy who knew what was going on, you know.
What about someone like Hilly Kristal, the operator of CBGB's? Would you think of him?
Hilly was great. Hilly was great. Hilly was wonderful. And he had this bouncer named Merv, who always wore a hard hat, you know. And Merv was wonderful, too, you know. Hilly's wife wasn't so wonderful, though. She was like, turn down the music! Turn it down! You're too loud! And Hilly would be passed out at 10 o'clock on the couch in front, you know. Hilly was great.
Did they live upstairs, Hilly and his wife?
I don't know where they lived.
That's, I was picturing.
No, they didn't live upstairs because upstairs was the Palace Hotel. It was the bum hotel, you know.
And one other, I guess, important component, and maybe they're mischaracterized and disrespected often, is the quote groupies, the female groupies, like and some of them end up being wives and the like. Connie Ramone, you know, she seems like a compelling figure. Sable Starr, you know, did you cross paths with these folks? And
oh yeah. Connie was a nightmare, as you can see in the book. Sable was okay, you know. Sable was more L.A., you know, and then she had an affair with Johnny Thunders and then later Richard Hell. But the interesting thing about punk and the whole thing at CBGB's was there was suddenly all these different women who you could model yourself after. There was Tina Weymouth, you know, who was kind of arty and stoic, and there was Patti Smith, who was arty and outrageous, and you know, there was Debbie. You know, you could adopt. Suddenly, there was more room for women too, you know, and more ways to be a woman and define yourself as a woman, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
And cool, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Though, you know, the status quo at that time and still today even would look at the way that those women were carrying themselves and say, you know, they're ne'er-do-wells. They are women that have no shame, no morals and the like. But I would venture to guess that you would say they're pretty strong people and pretty...
I morals, who gives a shit?
FCC legs.
About morals, you know? Because, I mean, they were interesting, and they were smart, and they were following their gut instincts, and they were, you know, reinventing themselves and redefining the culture, which was very, very cool, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Again, folks, we're talking to Roderick, a.k.a. Legs McNeil.
No one ever called me. My father named me Roderick, and then he died. And my mom, I didn't even know my name was Roderick until I went to the first grade. They called me Eddie after my dad. I didn't know my name was Roderick, so please don't call me Roderick.
I apologize.
I hate that name.
I apologize. It was listed in the book. I figured it was okay, but, you know. Do you want me to edit it out?
Sure. Sure, I'd love it.
If I can do it with ease, I will. If not, I apologize in advance. But, you know, the new book, the prequel, I guess you guys have been working on it for a decade or so, you and Jillian.
Yeah, about 15 years, yeah.
You call it a prequel, I guess, because we were talking about how glitter and glam led to punk, and then, you know, I guess we could even say that goes on to grunge maybe in the 90s. But before all this, you want to focus on how the effect 60s had on that chronological, you know, growth of music in America, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I think the subtitle should be The Uncensored Oral History of Hippie Noir, you know.
Hippie Noir. Why do you say Hippie Noir?
Because, you know, I always thought these people were into peace, and but they were a bunch of thugs. They were just like every other band at CBGB's. You know, the Birds were like, you know, everybody was carrying guns and
FCC legs.
You know, they were not what the image that we were told they were, you know.
So you're learning a lot of new things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, you weren't in that scene. You weren't in that scene. So is this more difficult as compared to putting together your book about the punk scene?
Yes, yeah. And we had to go out to L.A. a lot, you know, and interview people around there, you know. You know, especially it goes into the whole Manson thing, and the whole, you know, the Manson connection, and putting the whole Manson story into a rock and roll context, you know, which is where it should be, you know.
Why so?
Because Charlie was, you know, trying to be a rock star, or more of a rock god than a rock star, you know, because he wanted all these people to follow him to the desert and live out Armageddon or whatever delusion he had at the moment.
So he's a common thread in 69.
Well, a lot of people are. A lot of people are, you know.
Like who else?
Terry Melcher. He was producing The Byrds and Paul Revere and the Raiders and Greg Jacobson and Bobby Beausoleil, who's in Love for a moment. And you know, the whole California scene and the lesser scene, you know, the blue collar workers, you know, whose families were in camera or lighting or wardrobe, or, you know, the whole Hollywood structure of things, you know.
And you find a seamless transition into, you know, from the 60s into the 70s music scene? The influences, transformations and such?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it was Jan and Dean to the Beach Boys, and the Beach Boys into the Byrds, and the Byrds into Love, and the Love into the Doors, you know. Yeah, that's pretty, you know, I'm just taking, you know, name bands, but there are a lot of other people in there too, you know.
Yeah, Morrison, you mentioned he was a punk for sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Did you ever cross paths with him?
Jim Morrison? No. No. I did Dennis Wilson though.
Yeah? How was that?
I was really hungover. I was in LA in I think 1977. Might even been 78, and I was at Brother's studio with Jonathan Paley. I don't know why we were there. I was really hungover, and I was playing pinball in the front room, in the waiting room, and Dennis Wilson walked in, and I just pushed the ball back, and it drained. It went right down the middle, and Dennis looked at me like, "You
FCC legs,
an idiot." You know, and I was so humiliated. So that was my one run-in with Dennis Wilson.
That's a great one, yeah.
Yeah,
I remember reading an article that you wrote for Vice magazine about a morning of drinking with Norman Mailer.
Yeah, so Norman was great.
Yeah.
Norman was wonderful. Norman was fantastic. Norman was one of the most generous guys I've ever met, you know.
Man, you've hung out with some cool people, and you continue to, it seems. I guess either you're somebody that people can't shake off, or you're a pretty cool guy. I would think the latter.
I probably somebody who people can't shake off.
So we can look forward to 69 anytime, I guess, in the next, what, 2 to 3 years, 5 years, 6 months? What do you think?
2 years. 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
And right now, you know, we're sitting back.
Okay, you're the mathematician. When is the 25th anniversary of Please Kill Me?
Next year, 2021.
2021,
right?
Okay.
It was printed in...
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. So
yeah, 1996, yeah. Yeah.
That'd be great, wouldn't it, to do it
yeah.
then?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good plan.
Yeah, cool.
And,
well, thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, pleasure.
And I hope I've entertained you and whatever.
You have. You have.
Yeah, oh,
How are you dealing with the apocalypse right now?
Well, my life has changed very little because I just get up and work every day. You know, I never leave the house anyway. You know, so it's not like I'm missing out.
Well, I wish you the best. I really enjoy talking with you, and I love your work so much. I really do, and I look forward to 69.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice of you to say.
Take care of yourself, Legs.
You too. Have a good one.
Bye.
Well, the girls are frisky and old Frisco. Yeah, pretty little chick, man, wherever I go. Oh, whoa, 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 well, I'm out. And I'm out. And I'm robot. And
The Myth of Daedalus and Icarus by Thomas Bulfinch. The labyrinth from which Theseus escaped, by means of the clue of Ariadne, was built by Daedalus, a most skillful artificer. It was an edifice with numberless winding passages and turnings, opening into one another, and seeming to have neither beginning nor end, like the river Meander, which returns on itself, and flows now onward, now backward, in its course to the sea. Daedalus built the labyrinth for King Minos, but afterwards lost the favor of the king, and was shut up in a tower. He contrived to make his escape from his prison, but could not leave the island by sea, as the king kept strict watch on all vessels, permitting none to sail without being carefully searched. "Minos may control the land and sea," said Daedalus, "but not the regions of the air. I will try that way." So he set to work to fabricate wings for himself and his young son, Icarus. He wrought feathers together, beginning with the smallest and adding larger, so as to form an increasing surface. The larger ones he secured with thread, and the smaller with wax, and gave the whole a gentle curvature like the wings of a bird. Icarus, the boy, stood and looked on, sometimes running to gather up the feathers which the wind had blown away, and then handling the wax and working over with his fingers, by his play impeding his father in his labors. When at last the work was done, the artist, waving his wings, found himself buoyed upward and hung suspended, poising himself in the beaten air. He next equipped his son in the same manner and taught him how to fly, as a bird tempts her young ones from the lofty nest into the air. When all was prepared for flight, he said, "Icarus, my son, I charge you to keep at a moderate height, for if you fly too low, the damp will clog your wings, and if you fly too high, the heat will melt them. Keep near me, and you will be safe." While he gave him these instructions and fitted the wings to his shoulders, the face of the father was wet with tears, and his hands trembled. He kissed the boy, not knowing that it was for the last time. Then, rising on his wings, he flew off, encouraging him to follow, and looked back from his own flight to see how his son managed his wings. As they flew, the plowman stopped his work to gaze, and the shepherd leaned on his staff and watched them, astonished at the sight, and thinking they were gods who could thus cleave the air. They passed Samos and Delos on the left, and Labynthos on the right, when the boy, exulting in his career, began to lead the guidance of his companion and soar upward as if to reach heaven. The nearness of the blazing sun softened the wax which held the feathers together, and they came off. He fluttered with his arms, but no feathers remained to hold the air. While his mouth uttered cries to his father, it was submerged in the blue waters of the sea, which thenceforth was called by his name. His father cried, "Icarus, Icarus, where are you?" At last he saw the feathers floating on the water, and bitterly lamenting his own arts, he buried the body and called the land Icaria in memory of his child. Daedalus arrived safe in Sicily, where he built a temple to Apollo and hung up his wings, an offering to the gods. We'll be right back.
taste. It's stunning. I will purchase organic elderberry and boil it down into a paste to color my face with nature. End days reveal clear the maze we have all been inside, running. And there you have it, episode 362 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Mr. Legs McNeil, our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, and these musical artists, Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, The Velvet Underground, The New York Dolls, The Dictators, The Stooges, The Ramones, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. I should also mention Nico. Until next week, let's give it a go and try to enjoy this one. Thanks for listening, and take care.